You remember where you were 2 years ago when the pandemic was officially declared? Today on The World, we look back.
It wasn't just like that people were dying. It was the way the entire health system was like completely shut down because of COVID.
And we look ahead to prepare for what's next. Also today in Ukraine, under attack, the triage of children. Doctors are making painful choices.
If they get a whole group of children with war wounds, then they're told to put stickers on them. And a green sticker means that child's okay. Yellow means the child needs help.
Then there are the black stickers. Israel is walking a fine line, offering medical help to Ukraine, but no military assistance.
That would upset the apple cart of maintaining neutral or warm ties with both sides.
I'm Marco Werman. All of that and more here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for joining us this Thursday. On one hand, the Russian advance on Ukraine has slowed down. On the other, the destruction is becoming more severe. And Ukraine's health system, in particular, is taking a major toll from the assault. The World Health Organization has verified multiple attacks on health facilities, including a Russian airstrike on a maternity hospital yesterday in the port city of Mariupol. At least three people, including a child, were killed, according to the local government there. Many more were injured. The WHO says that in Ukraine, about 1,000 health facilities are located within 7 miles of the front lines. James Elder is a spokesperson for UNICEF. He joins us now from the western Ukrainian city of Lviv. James, what do we know at this point about the injuries and deaths caused by this Russian attack on the maternity hospital in Mariupol?
Well, pretty much as you said, Marco, we've yet another indiscriminate attack, this time on the place meant to be of such joy for families, having a first baby for the first time, and instead they're bombarded. So we know that there are a huge number of casualties. I don't have the exact figures. It just underscores again the horrific toll this war is exacting on Ukraine's children, on their families. Dozens of children have been killed to this point. I'm unsure how many died yesterday, but many more are going to be killed if the indiscriminate attacks, if the war doesn't stop, and of course, if humanitarian corridors aren't respected.
Do you have any news on how people at that hospital in Mariupol are doing today, both patients and professionals?
Well, yes, they're getting assistance, remembering that it's not the only hospital to have been hit. You've got surgeons working in genuine wartime conditions. So most surgery in some of these hotspots from Kiev to Kharkiv to Mariupol has been in bunkers and basements. And remembering a basement is very much a basement. So surgeons are working in extremely difficult conditions. Now they've got women with wounds of war who were days away from having babies. So they're treating them as best they can. An organization like UNICEF, actually, we are getting emergency surgical supplies across to some of those key areas for those surgeons who are running short. That, for the moment, has mostly been Kiev, because, again, every time you think you can get into Mariupol, you realize that the humanitarian corridor is not real. It's not being respected. Or as I spoke to someone the other day, they were told, go down that road, that's your way out, only to discover it was heavily mined.
So a very basic commodity for hospitals is water. We've been hearing about people boiling snow.
Ukrainians are hardy. So in places like that, and in the Donbas in the east, previously when there's been attacks on key infrastructure like water, they go to a river. Rivers are frozen, or you can't go to a river because you're being bombarded. So water's fundamental. In Mariupol, the last water trucking UNICEF did was a couple of days ago. It's extremely difficult and dangerous. I've had reports recounted to me of families going through their sort of oil heaters to somehow extract some water. There must be a coolant. So the water situation is dire and is going to get worse as we see these missiles, these attacks escalate on civilian areas.
It's very sad to imagine all this. I mean, this was not the first hospital, the one in Mariupol in Ukraine, to be targeted by Russian missiles. Overall, how is the war affecting the work of staff at hospitals across the country?
Yeah, I've spoken to quite a few doctors, and they're working in, I don't know, like MASH 4077. What's the reference point?
The MASH 4077 hospital unit in the TV show about the Korean War.
Yeah, lights strung up. People have got phones, half a dozen phones sort of joined together to create additional light. Kids have talked to me about being terrified in bunkers because of rats. These are those conditions. The doctors I spoke to in the west of the country who are now receiving children from Kiev, either with wounds of war or because these kids were in hospitals already and they just can't cope anymore in Kiev. Those doctors, I asked, how do you do it? You're a surgeon. Are you preparing yourself? I asked psychologically for what's coming. They, of course, were very practical. And they said, look, some of the things we're getting, James, is we're getting training in prioritization. And they explained that means if they get a whole group of children with war wounds, then they're told to put stickers on them. And a green sticker means that child's okay. You know, battered, bruised, they're okay. Yellow means the child needs help, needs attention. A red sticker means that child is critical. Someone somehow needs to get to it, that child. And a black sticker means that child is not going to make it. That's how what doctors are dealing with.
I was going to ask you about the kinds of medical cases that are coming in for treatment. I mean, it sounds really dire. It sounds like war.
Exactly. If you have something like we saw in Mariupol, that's bomb blasts, that's shrapnel, that's glass. So terrible wounds of war. And it doesn't take much for shrapnel. If you're in an area and you get glass spraying across, you can imagine. And worse, when rockets rip across, the sheer velocity. So I don't have expertise in that. Only in seeing the impacts. And again, it's ceasefire, an end to the war is critical. But if for whatever insane reasons that's unable to occur, then as humanitarian corridors, we have to be able to get these people out, these civilians out. And whilst that happens, then organizations like UNICEF and many others have to be able to get supplies, like you rightly mentioned, water in.
Has the war had an impact on the number of staff, medical professionals, getting into work at the hospitals?
Short answer, yes. But I've seen doctors coming, leaving Kiev and having to bring patients to where I was in the west of the country, and they need to go back, and they're trying to go back. There's no doubt the working conditions, as you and I spoke, there's no doubt there's moments where they're making plans for their families. You know, yet again, a husband and wife farewelling the other one and organising for their children to flee. The mental stress, the time, the organizing to, okay, what's my plan today? How am I going to try and get out to get food and so on? The things that would have you just do in the normal course of a day now obviously takes hours away from what those doctors would like to be doing.
So we spoke about the need for clean water. A shortage of drivers has actually slowed all kinds of deliveries of stuff across the country. How has that affected medical supplies? Like, what's missing from the supply cabinets?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. These are the problems of war, truck drivers or trucks. Supplies, well, less so. I mean, as I said, UNICEF, like the organization I work for, the biggest humanitarian supply hub on the planet is in Copenhagen, Denmark, which is in Europe, so closer than Thailand. So that's here. So we can get those supplies in. But as you say, then you've got to get them to those areas. So that's extremely difficult, whether it's drivers or trucks. We were here prior to this. So, you know, an agency like UNICEF has those local contacts, the local market and so on. It doesn't mean it's not extremely difficult and dangerous for those drivers. And the only way to end the trauma for kids and the danger for kids is for the war to end. But as I say, if that's not to occur, if humanitarian spaces aren't open and civilian areas are targeted, that's a horror show.
James Elder is a spokesperson for UNICEF. He was speaking with us from Lviv about the impact of the war on hospitals across Ukraine. James, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure, Marco.
2 years ago tomorrow, the planet officially entered a pandemic. From China, it quickly spread. SARS-CoV-2 has since made its way to every corner of the globe. The World's Alana Gordon reports on some of the lessons we've learned over the past 2 years and why the virus is still not going away.
By the time the pandemic alarm rang in 2020, SARS-CoV-2 had engulfed northern Italy. In an early interview on our show, Dr. Stefano Magnoni said he was just recovering from COVID in Bergamo.
We are seeing many doctors falling ill with this infection. Some of them are in the ICU as patients.
Infections were spreading fast from Iran to Peru.
The coronavirus crisis generates new and shocking numbers every day.
As the number of cases and deaths rises sharply,
there are now more than a million confirmed cases worldwide.
Emily Kumbasam, a health researcher at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, recalled everyone being glued to the news, watching the climbing numbers.
I think as public health workers, it was bigger than that. It wasn't just like that people were dying from COVID. It was the way the entire health system was like completely shut down because of COVID.
The early days of the pandemic proved just how connected the world is. The global message was to prepare and detect, to reduce the spread. Marcia Castro is a Brazilian demographer at Harvard's Chan School. She says one big lesson in those early responses is the approach can't be a one-size-fits-all.
The immediate reaction was close everything, which is a problem.
There's massive inequality in Latin America. In places that experienced some of the highest death rates from COVID, people lived close together and needed to leave the house to make a living and survive.
They tried to replicate things that worked in Europe without looking at the context and seeing that without giving some kind of support. So it just made it worse.
And Castro says in Brazil, the world learned another hard lesson.
The cost of bad leadership.
The Brazilian president's announcement was met with pot-banging protests.
Despite public health warnings, Brazil's president denied the severity of COVID-19 and minimized the response. Brazil and the U.S. had ranked at the top globally in pandemic preparedness before SARS-CoV-2. And yet they experienced some of the most deaths and infections in the world. In year two, the world's response to the pandemic shifted from uncertainty to hope. 90-year-old Margaret Keenan got the very first clinically approved vaccine in a hospital in the UK.
We knew a vaccine was coming. So there was a clear message to people, which was limit your interactions till a vaccine. This isn't forever. It's until, you know, you can get vaccinated and we can get through this.
Devi Schreeder is a professor of global health at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland. She says vaccines proved to be our most powerful tool, but we learned they couldn't be the only tool.
And then I think the next turning point was when we started seeing variants emerging.
Delta devastated countries like India, just as it was mounting a national vaccine campaign. But another surprising lesson came from a part of the world that has lacked access to vaccines.
It was expected from the beginning that when the pandemic hits Africa, it would be disastrous.
Kondwani Jambo is an immunologist at the Malawi Liverpool Wellcome Trust program. His research has found super high levels of exposure to the virus in places like Malawi. But
if you look at the severity of the infection, the severity of the pandemic is actually relatively mild compared to Europe or the Americas or elsewhere.
This can get more complicated because of possible underreporting in deaths. But he says he can't deny what he saw firsthand in underwhelmed hospitals. It's humbling.
Do not forget that Africa has had other pandemics before. Yeah? Do not underestimate the power of experience, of learning how to handle pandemics over time. Even though we don't have much of the resources, but there's some degree of resilience built into the system.
Today, entering year three, the world is in a different place. But Ali Mokhtad, an epidemiologist at the University of Washington, says that makes the place that has done the best job at keeping the virus out more vulnerable.
What will happen in China right now will determine the future of COVID-19, I mean, quite honestly.
WHO's Tedros Ghebreyesus gave a warning yesterday.
2 years later, more than 6 million people have died. Although reported cases and deaths are declining globally, the pandemic is far from over.
It's hard to fathom a number like 6 million, and it's an undercount. Dr. Carissa Etienne, head of the Pan-American Health Organization, said this week that far too many people haven't gotten their first dose of a vaccine, and the virus is still surging in some places.
We all want the pandemic to be over, but optimism alone cannot control the virus. It is too soon to lower our guard.
She says the pandemic's impact on society also goes well beyond the virus itself, and it'll be felt around the world for years to come. That will require a whole new kind of reckoning. For The World, I'm Alana Gordon.
Later in the program, we check in with our reporters around the globe about how their communities look now after 2 years of COVID. The war in Ukraine is being felt far from Europe. Coming up, how food prices in Latin America are affected by that war, and why Israel is trying to stay neutral. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Israel's Yad Vashem Holocaust Memorial announced today that it's suspending ties with a major donor. That would be the Russian billionaire Roman Abramovich, owner of the famed Chelsea soccer club. It is a small gesture from a nation that has stayed largely neutral on the situation in Ukraine. Israel has not imposed sanctions on Russia and has not sent weapons to Ukraine. Joining me now is Daniela Cheslow, reporter with Agence France-Presse in Jerusalem. First of all, Daniela, this announcement that Yad Vashem is cutting ties with Russian billionaire Roman Abramovich, given Israel's attempt at neutrality, how big a deal is that really?
Yad Vashem is the central Holocaust memorial in Israel. When foreign leaders come in, they always make a stop there, and its director, Danny Dayan, was appointed by the government. Last month, Yad Vashem announced a new strategic partnership with Roman Abramovitz. He's a billionaire perceived to be close to Russian President Vladimir Putin. He also holds Israeli citizenship. He's a major donor to Yad Vashem and other Israeli foundations and causes. A spokesman for the memorial told me that was an eight-figure donation. Abramovitz would have been the second largest donor. But after the UK slapped sanctions on Abramovich and other oligarchs today, including an asset freeze and travel ban, that same spokesman told me that in light of recent developments, Yad Vashem has decided to suspend the strategic partnership.
So looking at larger sanctions, Israel is not part of NATO, but there are many nations that support US and NATO in the sanctions against Russia. Why is Israel not taking part?
So Israel did join 140 countries last week in the United Nations voting to condemn Russia's, quote, aggression in Ukraine. But beyond that, not only has Israel not imposed sanctions, the government is underwriting Israeli airlines to keep flying to Russia. And it says that's because there are Jewish people in Russia who need to get out. But also, it's part of a broader balancing act. Israel says it has to maintain good ties with Moscow because Russian troops are present in Syria on Israel's northern border.
So on weapons assistance, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has been asking Israel to send weapons. Israel has not. Why not?
That would upset the apple cart of maintaining neutral or warm ties with both sides. Israel wants to help. It sent more than 100 tons of aid, and it's setting up a field hospital inside Ukraine's border. But it has really been very delicate to not be perceived as supplying any kind of military assistance to Ukraine.
So there is a role that Israel's playing, receiving Ukrainian refugees. How is Israel preparing for this arrival of a lot of people?
The country has said they expect as many as 100,000 Jewish immigrants from Ukraine and Russia. The Ministry of Immigration says they found 12,000 hotel rooms across the country where people can temporarily stay while they look for more shelter. People are making a lot of comparisons toward a different wave of immigration that happened in the 1990s when 1 million people left the collapsing former Soviet Union. And those people were taken. They found homes in Israel. They were pretty successfully integrated. So I think if we're talking about 100,000 people potentially coming to Israel, that number pales in comparison to previous waves of immigration.
Why does it seem that Israel wants to be neutral in this war?
Well, I think Israel is trying to position itself as someone who could be a mediator between the two sides. This past weekend on Saturday, Prime Minister Naftali Bennett, who observes the Sabbath, he broke his observation and he went to Moscow. He flew to meet Russian President Vladimir Putin. They met for 3 hours. And Bennett said that Israel had a, quote, moral obligation to help stem fighting in Ukraine. So far, nothing has come of it. But I think for the Israelis, they see that that might perhaps allow them to preserve their ties with Russia, that allow them to coordinate military strikes in Syria, and at the same time, maintain their ties to Ukraine, where the president is Jewish, where there's a large Jewish community. And I think Israel is trying to walk a fine tightrope and not upset either one of those relationships.
Daniela Cheslow, a reporter with Agence France-Presse in Jerusalem, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
The war in Ukraine has impacted countries well beyond Eastern Europe, especially when it comes to the price of food. That's because Ukraine is a major exporter of wheat and corn. Countries in Africa and Latin America also depend on Ukrainian fertilizer. From Bogota, Colombia, reporter Manuel Rueda has more on that.
Rosdari Cogollo runs a food stall at La Perseverancia, a busy market in Bogota. She specializes in ajiaco, a traditional soup made with 3 kinds of potatoes and chicken, boiled with onion and local herbs. It's made in a big pressure cooker. Cogollo says that lately her ingredients have been getting more expensive, and her business is struggling to stay afloat. A year ago, I was buying 100 pounds of potatoes for $12, she says. Now it can cost up to 4 times as much. Prices have gone through the roof. According to Colombia's government, food went up by 20% in January. And with the war in Ukraine, it could get even more expensive. That's because much of the fertilizer that's used to grow crops like potatoes or onions in Colombia comes from Russia and Ukraine. As the war rages on, fertilizer from these countries will be harder to ship. Global supplies will diminish, and it'll become more expensive to grow food. Rodolfo Correa is the Secretary of Agriculture in Antioquia, Colombia's second largest state.
For a long time, we haven't been self-sufficient when it comes to food production, he says.
So anytime there's a global crisis that affects fertilizer, prices of food here can go up. The cost for urea, one of the most common fertilizers, rose by 30% in futures markets since the war in Ukraine began. And Colombia isn't the only country that will be affected. In Argentina, a recent study said that up to 25% of the local wheat crop could be lost this year due to shortages of fertilizer. In Mexico, newspapers are reporting that tortillas have reached the highest prices in a decade because the war in Europe is also diminishing the global supply of corn. Before the war, Ukraine was the world's fourth largest corn exporter and the fifth largest wheat producer. African countries that were importing large amounts of wheat from Russia and Ukraine are already struggling to find new supplies. So some are trying to replace wheat with other cereals.
Prices are rising across the board, but not as much for things like sorghum or barley or millet, which are more domestically produced cereals in Africa.
Danielle Resnick is a researcher at the Brookings Institution, where she focuses on African economics.
In Senegal, the government is trying to encourage a production subsidy on rice.
But it's not easy to keep up these programs, Resnick says, because some countries were already given cash transfers to people affected by the pandemic.
Many of these governments are quite cash-strapped. Many are in debt distress or defaulted on their debt during the pandemic.
In Colombia, the number of people who don't eat three meals a day tripled during the pandemic and is now 30% of the population. And hunger could increase if food keeps on getting more expensive, says economist Luis Fernando Mejia. Colombians who live in poverty are already spending 25% of their income on food, he says. So changes in prices can force these families into malnutrition. As the war in Ukraine continues, Colombia has taken some measures to slow down food inflation, like dropping taxes on imports of grains and fertilizers. Plans are also underway to invest in local fertilizer factories.
40.
At the Perseverancia market, Magdalena Moreno notices that oranges are costing twice as much as they did a year ago. Now, we'll have to see what this war brings, she says. But even if everything's expensive, at least we're lucky that it's safe here. For The World, I'm Manuel Rueda in Bogota.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. 779. That's how many people donated to The World during the fall fundraising campaign. Those 779 people helped us surpass our goal of $67,000. And we want to thank some of those incredible people right now. Ketsueki Miyagawa, Linda Folsom, Lynn Dutton, Mark Cohen, Marnie Rossner, Martha Briscoe, Monica Case, Nat Smith, Randy Noakes, Rebecca Gamble. Also, thank you to not only the 779 donors, but to all of our listeners. We couldn't have done this without you. 2 years since the pandemic was declared, how'd the planet do?
I think it's pretty clear. It's a failing grade. I think we can't really congratulate ourselves for too much.
Many missteps, but some big lessons for the future, and an update on U.S. Marine veteran Trevor Reed in prison in Russia, as Americans have been told to leave the country. Still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. To state the obvious, where you live determines a lot in how COVID may be impacting your life. 2 years on, we asked our global correspondents to send us some snapshots of daily life in their cities, starting in Toronto with reporter Anita Elash.
It's the morning rush hour, and I'm in a place called The Pass in the city's financial district. It's a huge underground pedestrian mall that connects all the office towers downtown. Before the pandemic, this place would have been wall-to-wall people streaming through at this time of day. It is starting to come back to life, but just barely. Just in front of me are some revolving doors leading to the closest subway station, and people are trickling through maybe a dozen at a time. Everybody is wearing a mask, and most people are dressed casually, wearing jeans and sneakers. Across the hall, though, things are still looking really deserted. Most of the shops, for as far as I can see, still have their shutters down, and it's likely it's going to stay that way for a while. Most of the businesses in these complexes say they're not bringing people back to the office until later in March. For The World, I'm Anita Elash in Toronto.
I'm Chavi Sachdev in Mumbai, and I'm standing actually at the base of my own residential apartment building. My building is under repair. And while several men in yellow hard hats and gloves are stacking scaffolding, there are also three men hauling on ropes, getting beams up to finish one panel that has reached the 12th floor now. It will go up 28 floors. And it has been super noisy and it's going to get only worse. I actually miss the silence of the pandemic. It was eerie, but it was nice. In the last few months, it looks like all of Mumbai has started making construction noise with a vengeance. Mumbai's metro line is being built. Overhead passes are being fixed. Roads are being reconstructed. And of course, buildings are being fixed up. This noise is what we live with every day. For The World, I'm Chavi Sachdev in Mumbai.
I'm Telho Presh in São Paulo, Brazil. It's lunchtime and I'm inside a Kilo restaurant called Prato Sete here in the district of Pompeia. In a Kilo restaurant, you get in line and serve yourself with the options displayed on a counter. After you're done picking your food, an attendant weighs your plate. The heavier it is, the more you'll pay. Workers from different sectors go to these places for their convenience, especially on weekdays and lunch hours. Here at Prato Sete, the attendance is not as it used to be, but it's okay. There are about 10 people in line right now, and half of the tables are occupied. There are salad, pie, meat, cauliflower, sausage, fried eggs, french fries, pasta, and of course, rice and beans. The smell is delicious. Because of the decreasing numbers of cases and deaths, and also of a widespread feeling here in Brazil that the worst part of the pandemic is over, some of the clients returned this year. Still, here at Prato Sete, there is a huge alcohol dispenser at the entrance of the restaurant. All employees are wearing masks, and there are disposable gloves at the beginning of the line, which consumers have to wear while serving themselves. After you're done, the typical complimentary coffee is now served here in Prato Sete in an external part of the restaurant. You get that boost from caffeine after lunch and go on with your day, with no hanging around. For The World, I'm Telho Prest in São Paulo.
So that's a view today from a few places across the globe. We also wanted to look back at the past 2 years. For that, we turned to Suri Moon. She's co-director of the Global Health Center at the Graduate Institute of Geneva. I asked her if she were to give a grade for how the globe responded to the pandemic. What would it be?
I think it's pretty clear. It's a failing grade. The fact that we are still in the middle of this pandemic, it's certainly not over yet. If we look at the number of deaths, the continued spread of the virus, the economic fallout, I think we can't really congratulate ourselves for too much.
Well, that's not good, Aneth. So let's go back to the start of the pandemic in early 2000. What went right about how the world responded?
What went right? Well... If we think back to the early days, I do think that WHO largely did what it was supposed to do, which is to get information from China, to share that information as quickly as it could, and then try to wake up the world to the threat of what was coming. They weren't perfect in how they performed, but largely they did what they were supposed to do. I think the other thing that has been a bright spot is the mobilization of science and expertise in things like the rapid development of a vaccine and of various treatments and diagnostic tests, in the tremendous mobilization of researchers who've helped us to understand, what is this virus? What are the effects? How is it transmitted? Who is more vulnerable? I mean, we've had an amazing outpouring of scientific effort over the last 2 years, much of it shared openly, quickly, without too much ego involved. So I think these are really bright spots, I would say.
So let's unpack that F grade. What didn't go so well and pointed to larger problems in the months ahead? What is at the top of your list?
The slowness of governments to react at the beginning and to take this seriously. The inability of health authorities worldwide to provide, clear, persuasive messaging to their people. The rise of mistrust, distrust, disinformation, some of which was quite intentional. Some of which I think was more accidental, but I think this is really a dark side of the pandemic that, of course, linked to many other social and political problems.
Suri, as far as vaccines go, I mean, it was impressive the speed with which a number of vaccines were developed, but they've not been treated equally. Some vaccines have been considered gold standards, others not so much. What is the lesson there?
It has turned out that some vaccines are better than others, safer than others, more accessible than others. And I think one of the lessons we can take away is that we actually do need multiple products. And we also need production in many more countries than we had in this pandemic. We not only didn't have enough vaccines for the world, but the fact that so many of those vaccines ended up in the hands of wealthy countries is partly a result of the fact that wealthy countries also controlled many of the factories that were able to produce these vaccines. So if we want to be able to ensure more equitable access in the future, it's really, really crucial to invest in building up that production capacity in different countries around the world. And I do think this is one of the lessons that has actually been learned and digested. We do see many, many efforts now to increase the ability to produce mRNA vaccines in South Africa. There are efforts in Southeast Asia as well. But if we cannot agree on a way to share intellectual property, information and technology in the event of the next potential pandemic, all of these new factories that are being built are just going to sit idle.
Vaccine hesitancy, in some cases mixed with politics, it turned out to be a huge problem, especially here in the United States. What is the lesson there in terms of planning for the next pandemic? Is there any way to avoid that?
I hope so. One of the benefits of what has happened, if we can grasp it, if we can learn this lesson, is that we have a better understanding of hesitancy than we did before. And what we see in some countries, for example, is that, you know, there's kind of a hardcore of people who really, really will refuse. And I think there's not that much that public health authorities can do. But there's a whole swath of people who can be persuaded through a number of different means, whether it's advice from your healthcare provider, public messaging, whether it's incentives like vaccine passes. You know, there is actually quite a lot you can do to persuade that sort of undecided middle. And I think these are important lessons for the future. We cannot count on 100% of the population to come forward in many countries. I think that's going to remain the case. But what can we do to indeed change some minds? I think we've learned a lot about the different measures that we can adopt for that.
So, Suri, one of the most profound aspects of the pandemic is that in the 21st century, the world was effectively shut down for months and months. Do you think there's even a chance that with the next pandemic, and there will be one, as experts tell us, nations will try and be more cooperative?
I certainly hope so. I do think that one of the longer term effects of this pandemic is on geopolitics. You know, there are some who believe that Vladimir Putin's decision to invade Ukraine had something to do with his isolation, you know, over the last couple of years due to COVID. Mobilizing global cooperation is going to be extremely difficult in the next pandemic. I think the rise of other centers of power, you know, the rise of China as a competitor to the West, not just as a source of vaccines, but as a source of financial aid and many other types of resources for developing countries, you know, it changes the game. But if we can get governments to agree through a pandemic treaty, the negotiations for this start in just a few days, if governments can agree on binding, strong, effective international rules that they are willing to commit to comply with in the event of the next crisis, I think these are the kinds of steps that have to painstakingly be taken in order to make global cooperation the better choice for politicians in the next crisis.
Suri Moon, co-director of the Global Health Center at the Graduate Institute of Geneva. Thanks very much for looking back on these past 2 years with us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Picture this. You get on a plane, fly to a warm, sunny island somewhere on the other side of the world, and then you get stuck. This is exactly what's happened with thousands of tourists from Ukraine and Russia. The world's Tibisay Seya reports.
It was supposed to be a relaxing beach vacation in the Dominican Republic, but it's turned into a nightmare for Yuri Tevchenko. He and his girlfriend traveled from Kiev to the Caribbean beach paradise of Punta Cana 3 weeks ago. They had plans to stay at an all-inclusive resort for a week, and then the war started back home.
I got the news from my friend that one guy who was studying with me at university, and after that we worked together and lived together at the same house. He was killed with his family at the village by a Russian bomb.
Suddenly, Tevchenko and his girlfriend were stranded. They are actually part of a group of about 2,000 Ukrainians in the Dominican Republic who haven't been able to get a flight home.
When you can't eat normally, can't laugh, can't do anything that usually tourists do. And we are very worried about our our families, our friends, the people that we know.
Tevchenko says Dominican hospitality has been generous. The Dominican government has designated a beach resort to host stranded tourists for 2 weeks, all meals included. But in spite of all that, many Ukrainian tourists are eager to get back home.
I heard from men that they can't wait to go back so they can join the fights. You know, a lot of women are saying that they are going back and they will be helping as well.
Katarina de los Santos is a Ukrainian immigrant who lives on the island. She's helping with the humanitarian effort for tourists stuck in the Dominican Republic. She's organizing volunteers, and she set up a social media group with more than 1,000 members.
The response has been amazingly warm. So I get phone calls where people say, oh, you know, I work as a taxi driver and I'm okay to drive somebody for free. Somebody calls and says, oh, I would love to cook some meals. I have a house or I have a room. I have spare bed.
De Los Santos also helped organize an anti-war protest in Punta Cana. It attracted hundreds of locals and tourists from all over the country, including people from Russia. Protesters raised money to help people get back home. De Los Santos says getting a flight from Punta Cana to Europe is not easy.
The main issue mostly is the money, because when there is the war going on, whatever savings you have, like a couple hundred dollars, you know, you don't know how long you'll have to stretch them.
There are more than 1,000 Russian tourists stuck in the Dominican Republic, according to tourism officials. But Russian travelers are in a less stressful situation, according to Pepe Villalba. He speaks Russian and works as a tourist guide in Punta Cana. He says itineraries were canceled or delayed, but Russians have been able to find daily flights back home. Sanctions against Russian banks are not yet active, but some tourists have reported on social media that they are unable to get cash out of ATMs. On the day the war started, Villalba says, all the Ukrainians who booked day trips with him canceled their reservations. The Russians, he says, they all made the trip. However, the whole time they didn't say a single word about the war in Ukraine. Tourists are going through similar situations in other parts of the world. In Egypt, around 20,000 visitors from Ukraine are stranded at resorts on the Red Sea. In Cuba, Russian tourists took emergency flights back home. And on the island of Zanzibar in Tanzania, almost 1,000 Ukrainians are stuck without a way out and they are seeking diplomatic assistance. For the world, I am Tivisa Isaiah.
The votes have been counted in South Korea, and the country's next president will be a hard-charging conservative, a political novice who's staunchly pro-U.S. and determined to take a tougher line on North Korea. And that's the thumbnail profile of Yoon Suk-yeol, who won the race against the left-leaning ruling party by a razor-thin margin. The World's Patrick Nguyen joins us now to explain how Yoon's five-year term could shake things up inside and outside South Korea. So what can South Koreans expect from President-elect Yoon, Patrick?
Well, you said it, Marco. It will be a shakeup. Yoon Suk-yeol is an outsider. He's not a traditional politician. He was a big-shot government prosecutor. And he can be a little brash. He sometimes says things that rile up his right-wing base, things about feminism. Feminism really was a huge buzzword for this election. In recent years, the country has had its own Me Too movement and then a backlash movement of young men who say feminism has gone too far. And President-elect Yoon tapped into that anti-feminist wave to get votes. So obviously there are many other issues facing South Korea. Housing costs are sky high. There aren't enough white-collar jobs. Of course, Marco, there's North Korea, which did play a big role in his campaign.
Yeah, Yoon says he wants to take a tougher line with North Korea. What exactly is he talking about?
Yeah, it's no more Mr. Nice Guy. That's what we're going to see moving forward. The outgoing president, Moon Jae-in, had this dream of making peace with North Korea. And you'll remember him hugging Kim Jong-un. And he was part of bringing Donald Trump over to meet Kim Jong-un. We can say goodbye to all of that. Yoon is very clear. He says North Korea is our, quote, principal enemy. He even says preemptive strikes are on the table if North Korea looks like it's about to launch a nuke. So I think we can expect boosted military cooperation with the U.S. and to only push ahead with North Korea talks if they get rid of their nuclear bombs first, which is, of course, the classic American position.
So from Washington's perspective, the regional superpower in Asia is China. What is Yoon Suk-yeol's position toward China?
It will be more defiant than in the past. South Korea is really pulled in two directions here. Its military is obviously intertwined with that of the U.S. We have many troops there. And yet the top trading partner is China and will be for the foreseeable future. So the outgoing president, he tried to leave it ambiguous, saying we're not partial to one or the other, U.S. or China. Yoon says, no, I am Team USA, and that's that. And again, he's tapping into public sentiment. 75% of South Koreans now say they see China negatively. That has shot way up. That has doubled in recent years. And I don't think it's a coincidence, Marco, that the first person to call and congratulate him after his election win was President Joe Biden.
There was Patrick Nguyen with the news that Yoon Suk-yeol will be the next president of South Korea. Patrick, thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
The U.S. State Department has advised all Americans to leave Russia. For some, that's not possible right now. Former U.S. Marine Trevor Reed has been in detention there since 2019. That's more than 900 days. Russian authorities charged Reed with assaulting a police officer. The U.S. ambassador to Moscow has called the evidence flimsy and preposterous. Reed is now serving a 9-year sentence. Trevor Reed's family believes that his detention was political and that Moscow is essentially using him as a bargaining chip. Now, with Russia waging war in Ukraine, negotiations for Reed's release have become even more complicated. We're joined now by Joey Reed, Trevor Reed's father. Mr. Reed, when was the last time you were able to be in touch with Trevor?
We spoke with him this morning. The prison started allowing him to make phone calls to us last Friday. He hadn't called in 232 days, and all of a sudden, they're letting him call us, and he's called 4 days since last Friday, and we spoke to him this morning.
What can you tell us about how Trevor is doing, like his health, where he is in Russia, and his treatment by the authorities there?
He's in the Republic of Mordovia. He's 8 hours' drive southeast from Moscow. The prison camp is IK-12. The American officials had never been to that prison before. It's out, like most of them in that area, they're all out, you know, in the forest. Trevor says you can hear the wolves at night. They're not coyotes, they're wolves. It's very cold there. You know, they had heavy snow banks. A lot of that's melted now. His condition is deteriorating, which it has been for the last year. He had COVID back in May when he was in Moscow. Their treatment for that was to move the prisoners that had it to another hospital prison and give them vitamins. In July, he was moved to this prison camp. And then in January, Trevor started having, he's had a cough off and on, but he started having severe cough and some blood in his cough. And now he's coughing up blood basically throughout the day, every day. He has a fever off and on. He has headaches. Yesterday, we were informed that there'd been an accident and something fell on him. And he thinks he might have a broken rib. So now every time he coughs, he has a stabbing pain in his chest. His teeth are going bad. His gums are receding. He had back surgery the year before he went. He's got chronic pain from that. So it's just getting worse and worse. And his morale is deteriorating.
It's a terrible situation. I'm so sorry. Just this week, Mr. Reed, you and your wife spoke on the phone with President Biden about your son's case. What did the president say to you?
Well, it was a brief phone call. We were waiting outside the event that he was at here in Fort Worth, Texas, which, by the way, was at the VA clinic where my son received treatment before he went to Russia to visit his girlfriend. So while we were waiting outside with banners, he saw us when he drove by. And so while he was in the event, he called us and said, hey, was that you I saw out there? And, you know, my wife said, yes, sir. And he said, oh, I'm so sorry. You know, we've got this long convoy and the Secret Service doesn't like to stop in an area that we haven't prepared for. And I apologize. And Paula said, you know, oh, we understand. And he said, no, you shouldn't have to understand. He said, I want you to know that I think about your son every day. He said, I pray for him every day. He said, I said a rosary for your son on our way to Fort Worth. He said several other things that I don't want to disclose, but they were exactly the things you want to hear from your president. He did say that I'm going to do everything I can to get your son and Paul Whelan home from Russia. They shouldn't be there. You know, this is a bunch of bunk.
Paul Whelan, another American in detention there.
Yeah, he's been there 8 months longer than my son, also on trumped up charges. We talk to his family weekly, and it's just they've taken these people. our Americans to try and get some criminals back that they have in our prisons. And we're all positive of that.
In your opinion, Mr. Reed, has Russia's war against Ukraine changed the status of your son's case?
Yes, obviously, everything is more contentious. We're sure that the lines of communication have diminished. There's a skeleton crew working at the giant embassy in Moscow, although they've been fantastic. Trevor's actually not being allowed to call us for the first time, was allowed to call the embassy. So they're having to act as operator and transferring his calls to us. Mm. And we've been told if back before this happened, that if the war did break out, that, you know, it would make things more difficult. We believe they're going to keep, you know, lines of communication open, just as they did throughout the entire Cold War. Any negotiations on prisoners is kept on generally a separate track, as they call it.
We were speaking on the show the other day about WNBA player Brittany Griner, who also was recently detained in Russia. I wonder if her family reached out to you and whether you have advice for them.
No, they haven't. And our representatives have reached out to them. But at this time, they obviously have chosen to work through other channels behind the scenes. And we respect that completely. There's many other hostage families that do the same. In our son's case, because of his prior job as a presidential guard protecting President Obama and Vice President Biden, we felt that the public needed to know that they've taken him because of that reason. And we believe that the more public awareness there is of what's happening, the more support there will be for the president to make a decision that maybe they wouldn't normally want to do.
When you think about Trevor in a Russian prison, how does he cope with stress and uncertainty? I mean, do you have a good example of that?
Yeah, my son, the way he copes with it is the same way he did in Marine boot camp. You just hunker down and you keep moving forward and take things as it come, and you expect the worst. And in his situation right now, he's not even hoping for the best. His attitude in the last few days when we've now been able to talk to him, he's decided that he's not coming home. And in fact, I believe in his mind, he believes that he may never come home.
How does that strike you when you think about that?
It's heartbreaking. And quite frankly, the United States government has spoken out for him, and the SPIHA office, you know, the Special Presidential Envoy on Hostage Affairs has been extremely helpful. And the embassy has been fantastic. Ambassador Sullivan is our hero. But when it comes to the higher levels of administration, either they've decided they're not going to do this or they can't decide what they're going to do. And it's extremely frustrating. And if I was sitting in solitary confinement in a third world prison, because of the fact that I was a highly, he had a Yankee White top secret clearance. Okay, they don't just let anyone stand next to the president of the United States with a machine gun. So when you've done that job and then you're being held by an adversary because you had that job, you would think that your government would do whatever it takes to get you back. We believe that there's things our government could have done all along, and they, for whatever reason, just haven't. And so that's very frustrating, and we understand the way my son is feeling.
Joey Reed is the father of former U.S. Marine Trevor Reed, who is in prison in Russia, currently serving a 9-year sentence on what's widely believed to be trumped-up charges. Mr. Reed, thank you very much for speaking with us.
If I could say one other thing.
Please.
I didn't say this earlier. Ms. Griner's family, we feel for them and for her, and we hope that, you know, the U.S. government can get her out of there as soon as possible, and Paul Whelan and his family, and we always want to mention them and let their families know you're not alone.
Thank you very much for adding that. Joey Reed, thank you very much for being with us again.
Thank you.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for listening. From PR.